Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and I'm coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast tonight, 68 degrees and cooling down. Going to get down in the lower 50s tonight. Very nice. Very nice. We have a tremendous program for you tonight. The solar wind is at the lowest we have ever recorded here at X Squared Radio. It's barely 250 kilometers per second. The weakest solar max in 100 years continues today with another 24 hours of absolute quiet. None of the sunspots on the Earth side of the sun are actively flaring. And there have been a number of very strange fireballs the last few days. I saw one last night go streaking over North Carolina, headed for Ohio. Like Ohio got hit just a couple of days ago by another fireball. Burned a lady's house down. They don't know if the people were home or not. But the house burnt to the ground. They're going through the ashes now to look for remnants. And there have been earthquakes and volcanoes virtually all over the place. I want to talk a little bit about this. First of all, I want to let you know that our phone lines are open all night tonight. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. And also, if you want to call us anywhere on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. That's 530-413-9537. And we have a lot of people that listen to the program via the conference line. That number, if you haven't already got it in your speed dial, is 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000. And then you put in the passcode 769-608. Hold on a second. The host is... Oh, okay. Lots and lots of great features coming. We're going to be upgrading the BBS interface next month, and you'll be able to have all kinds of features. You can even grab some of this information, stick it on your local radio station if you've got a gap this time frame. And the sound quality is going to be much better. It's going to be up to 128K, which is really, really clear. Not that tinny 36K like you hear on some of the other stations. If you want to use that conference line, it's very handy. You can put it in your speed dial. And here's what I do. I put in 805-399-1000, then comma, comma, on your iPhone, it's pause, pause, and then the 769-608 pound. Then when you speed dial at about the time when the auto message says enter your passcode, the pause is time out, and your speed dial will automatically put the passcode in. So it's basically one push, and you're into Channel 2 at BBS Radio. You can listen to the other hosts as well on Channel 2, but we prefer that you stick right here with X Squared Radio. All right. There was an earthquake off the coast of Pakistan. Barely half an hour after the quake, after they were jolted by a major earthquake on Tuesday of this week, people of the Pakistani coastal town of Gwadar had another shock when they saw a new island emerge in the sea just over a kilometer from the shore. It's about 3,900 feet, which is a little more than a stone's throw, but still alarming. A local journalist, Bahram Balakh, received the news via a text message from a friend. It said, "A hill has just appeared outside my house. And I stepped out and I was flabbergasted. I could see this gray dome-shaped body in the distance like a giant whale swimming near the surface. Hundreds of people had gathered to watch it in disbelief. I'm shaking my head a little bit right here because they said they could hear the hissing sound of the escaping gas. Mr. Balakh and some friends took a little skiff and motorboated out to the island, landed on it on Wednesday morning to check it out and to take pictures. It's an oval-shaped island, which is about 250 feet to 300 feet long and about 60 to 70 feet above the water. That's high. That's a couple of telephone poles. It has a rough surface, much of which is muddy, and some parts are mostly made up of a fine to coarse-grained sand. One part of it is solid rock, and that is where Mr. Balakh and his friends landed. I guess they didn't want to get mud on their shoes. Observers embrace a rare opportunity to tread on the land from this island that has pushed up from the seabed. Not too bright. Not too bright. There were dead fish on the surface. And on one side, they could hear the gas hissing out of the rock structure, Mr. Balakh said. Although they couldn't smell the gas, they're really lucky they couldn't, by the way, they did put a match to the fissures from where it was oozing and set it on fire, meaning that it's probably methane. That is very strange, because the five gases associated with volcanic activity are CO2, it's colorless and odorless and definitely not flammable, sulfur dioxide, which is a colorless gas, but it stinks. And if you breathe it in, it will cause almost immediate lockdown of your lungs. The first breath will put you on your knees, and the second breath can kill you. Hydrogen sulfide, also colorless. It is a flammable gas, but it has a pungent smell of rotten eggs because of the sulfur. Exposure to about 150 parts per million, which is about enough to smell, causes eye irritation. But exposure to 1,000 to 2,000 ppm, which is a good breathful of it, can cause a coma after a single breath. They have H2S alarms on oil rigs, and when the alarm goes off, you better get that gas mask on or you're going to be dead. Lots and lots of people on drill rigs have been killed over the years. 10 people on a single rig back in the 20th century. Water vapor is the other one, which could be steam, but I'm sure that you would see the white plumes as that was coming around. Also not flammable. Hydrochloric acid, which would definitely account for the dead fish. Not something that you would want to set a match to, although it's not flammable. By the time you end up flicking the Bic, your thumb is going to fall off your hand. It's very acidic. Helium, which is a noble gas, not flammable, has no odor, and is pretty much harmless, although you can suffocate if you get trapped in helium. Radon, which is radioactive, it's a very light particle. It is a daughter of uranium that's deep in the ground. It has about a 2.5 to 4 day half-life, which makes it very dangerous to human life, because if you ingest it, which is very easy to do in your lungs, it will decay before the weekend and it kills tissue. If you ingest enough of it, it'll kill you. If you ingest a fair amount of it chronically, it'll give you cancer. Of course, sulfuric acid, similar to the hydrochloric acid, except it does have an odor. And hydrofluoric acid. Now, hydrofluoric acid is colorless. It is kind of a fuming liquid with a pungent smell. But if you sniff it in, it's going to strip the lining right out of your lungs. It's extremely reactive. We use hydrofluoric acid in water to clean brick. But we use lots of water, so it's quite poisonous. If the gas was flammable and had no odor, obviously it was none of these. By the way, if it was, all of these onlookers would be dead, as I said. This is a structural upheaval that is indicative of huge tectonic forces. A swell of this size pushing that up not only from the seafloor but through the surface, 60 feet up above the surface. It would be the top layers of a supervolcano. If this blows up by any by allowing the subterranean liquids to flash to gas, well, the coast of Pakistan would be wiped out. You wouldn't even find it on the earth. The tsunami in the other direction would impact the states bordering the Arabian Sea and possibly Australia. Yeah, that's something I want to motorboat out to and just light it on fire just to see if it will burn. Here's what they said. We put the fire out in the end, but it was quite a hassle. Not even the water would kill it unless, you know, one poured buckets over it. So bright, these people. Hey, let's see if it burns. Light it up. I'm not lighting it. You light it. Okay, give me the lighter. And those were the last words we heard from him. The rest is a blur. Well, the story now doing the rounds is that Gwadar had this hill jut out of the sea 60 or 70 years ago, and that the elders had then named it Zalzala Ko, or the Quake Hill. Tuesday's earthquake shook Balochistan. They say Tuesday's earthquake has brought the little island that once appeared in 1945 after an earthquake, and their story is not entirely incorrect. However, the quake hill that appeared in 1945 was not near Gwadar, but over 100 kilometers to the east, although it was along the same coastline, which is called Makran Coast. About 700 kilometers from east to west, the Makran Coast is characterized by high seismic activity and is home to several hills called mud volcanoes, having craters at the top of them from which methane gas seeps. These volcanoes, located inland, have been there for a long time, but similar formations that emerge offshore are usually washed away by the sea by simple erosion. Geologists say it is part of the continuing process of continental drift, or the drift of landmass across the oceans, that brought the Indian subcontinent to collide with Eurasia and created the fault lines, some of which run through the Makran Coast. They also go up around the Arctic and back down the Pacific. The island that popped up is the fourth in this region since 1945, said Rashid Tabrez. He is from the Institute of Oceanography Gas Activation. Rashid, the director of the Karachi-based National Institute of Oceanography, says the energy released by the seismic movements of these fault lines activates inflammable gases in the seabed. The seabed near the Makran coast has vast deposits of gas hydrates, or frozen gas having a large methane content. These deposits lay compressed under a sediment bed that's about 300 to 800 meters thick. That's about a quarter to half a mile. When the plates along the fault line move, they create heat, and the expanding gas blasts through the fissures in the Earth's crust, propelling the entire seabed to the surface. If the heat associated with that action exceeds 500 degrees F and it mixes with air, the blast would leave a hole in the sea that it would take half an hour to refill. The island that popped up near Gwadar is the fourth in this region, as I said, since 1945, but it's the third in the last 15 years. Pretty scary stuff. Lots going on. Earthquakes, volcanoes, upheavals in strange places. Not totally strange places. We had one in a volcano in Italy yesterday. Hold on a second. Apple juice tonight. Delicious. It would seem a new volcanic vent has formed and is ejecting gas and sand about 100 meters off the coast of Fiumicino, west of Rome. And the phenomenon has started less than 24 hours ago, and the mayor outside Montino, along with his staff and experts from the National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology, are headed to the scene to the foothills. At the moment, in fact, there is no news about the possible links that there have been between this event and the past, showing the opening of many volcanoes in the two Viale Coccia di Morto. On August 27th, just about a month ago, a volcanic vent opened up near Fiumicino, ejecting steam and gas. These two events could be related, and may suggest that geology under Italy is in the midst of massive changes. There are dozens of active and very restless volcanoes sitting on the seafloor of the Tyrrhenian Sea, which is located off the tip of the boot of Italy. It's kind of the same area as Pompeii. Should be familiar to you, even though that's a land-based volcano. All right, in the news, obviously very, very hot in the news, is this Affordable Health Care Act and all of the political posturing that's going with it. Now, I could tell you that a lot of this is very, very complex because you have magicians and propagandists on all corners flashing their cards and playing their magic tricks for you to keep you occupied. And it depends greatly on whether you are a liberal or whether you are a conservative or whether you are a libertarian as to which magician you're going to believe. And by the way, plenty of clowns and plenty of clown cars going with this. So it takes a scientist to crack this apart. And what I'm going to do, and I think it's worth it to do this. I'm going to read John Mackey's story. And I believe this is really the true healthcare reform debate. I pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Trust me. All that handle yanking and megaphoning is just a bunch of phony malarkey. Here is what we're really talking about. By the way, Margaret Thatcher had a great quote. As you know, prior to the Nazis coming to power, the prior regime, the Reich, decided that the way that they would get control of the people, the way they would secure economic and political control over the masses was to provide national health care. And Margaret Thatcher had this to say: the trouble with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. Well, in this case, the money is yours. It's money that's taken from your paychecks. I know, you're thinking, oh, but it's the corporate taxes that pay for all that. I can tell you right now, there's no such thing as corporate taxes. I know, you're telling me it's 35%, that's what it is in corporations, and that's why they left the United States, and they're all operating offshore. I understand that. Believe me, I know. I have corporations myself. But I don't pay the taxes, and neither do they. You do. The taxes are rolled into the price of the thing that you buy. So the corporation doesn't pay a dime of those taxes. You do. It's a tax on you. You're the productive one. With a projected $1.8 trillion deficit for 2009, several trillions more in deficits projected over the next decade, and with both Medicare and Social Security entitlement spending about to ratchet up several notches over the next 15 years as baby boomers become eligible for both, we are rapidly running out of other people's money. These deficits are simply not sustainable. It can't be done. You understand what I'm saying? It can't be done. Nothing can be done about it. You cannot sustain it. They are either going to result in unprecedented new taxes and inflation, or they will bankrupt us. And guess what? Both of them are happening. We're seeing it right now. We are about 42 hours away from defaulting as a nation on our debt obligations. And by the end of this program, we will be about 39 hours away from that occurring. Now, this is where the magicians come in, because one set of magicians is going to blame the other set of magicians. And this is what it boils down to. While we clearly need health care reform, the last thing our country needs is a massive new health care entitlement that will create hundreds of billions of dollars of new unfunded deficits. This is what we call in the industry unfunded mandates. Unfunded mandates are when the government decides to add a fee to something that would normally be free. In other words, let's say the minimum wage is $8. And the federal government, in their great wisdom, says that is just simply not a living wage. People cannot support a family of three on $8 an hour. So we're going to make the minimum wage $10 an hour. Boom, it's $10 an hour. So now we have a 20% increase in the price of the bottom wage earner. Now, the bottom wage earner is the guy that just walks in the door. Do you know what we do? No, but I'm trainable. Okay, fine. We'll put you on a training program, and in a year's time, you'll be a really valuable employee. But what about the guy that hired on a year ago who is now already a valued employee, and now he's getting $10 an hour? He's earned it. He raised himself up from $8 to $10 an hour. Well, he's not going to stay. There's no way. If the new guy coming in the door that doesn't know squat is going to get $10, I want $12. Well, the employer has no choice, or he's going to lose his skilled employee. So he raises him to $12. But now the guy that's been there for 3 years and is a supervisor level, he can actually do it so well that he can train others. He's the guy that's making $12 an hour. And why should the guy that's only been here a year make the same as me? I want to raise to $14 an hour. And now you see what happens. That is what we call an unfunded mandate. That is where the federal government or state government steps in and artificially pushes the costs where they need to go, in their opinion. Now, what happens to the employer is the hours that he is logging from his people that are the cost of goods sold for whatever he's making stay the same because the product has to go out the door, but his costs go up about 30 to 35% across the board. Where do you think he's going to get that money? That's exactly right. He's going to raise his prices. And that's exactly what happens. That's called inflation. In fact, it is the only way inflation occurs. It's the only way inflation occurs. When government steps in and artificially pushes the cost of something up by either printing money or changing the cost of goods sold artificially, that's an unfunded mandate. That's what causes inflation. So that's what I'm talking about here. Now, in healthcare, obviously we have seen the costs go up, but they're not terrifically associated with the actual work being done. I mean, doctors aren't being paid that much more now than they were in 1985. But the cost of doing business has gone up because of the insurance costs. Not only the malpractice, but also the processing of your claim that you're filing. When you go to the doctor, they file a claim on your behalf. The insurance company guarantees the health provider that so much money, whatever they're going to make, and the healthcare provider tries to figure out a way to take in the money from the insurance company and still make a profit. So you actually get less healthcare, and you don't care because you're only going to pay a $20 copay or $25 copay, and you got a $5 drug card, so you don't care. Your employer is paying the $600 to $900 a month that it takes to provide you with that family policy. And they pass the cost on to the customer, which, by the way, has to earn more money in order to buy the product that you're making while you're at your employer. Now, this is why it gets so complex. because people cannot distinguish the difference between health care and health insurance. Health insurance costs the average family about $10,000 a year. So if you're out there and you work, let's say you work 25 years at your employer, or let's say 30 years at your employer, and that employer pays $800 a month for you, for your health insurance and your three kids. That's $9,600 a year that gets paid out in insurance costs. Times 30 years is about that's pretty close to $300,000. I doubt very seriously that any one of you listening to this program tonight, certainly not me, have ever spent $300,000 in health care costs. And sometimes what the health care provider does is they put in all this stuff that you never get and you don't want. All those sponges and tubs and wraps and bandages and all that stuff. Well, they make about 90% profit on that stuff. Sometimes $300 or $400 profit. And or 300 or 400% profit on that stuff. You don't need it. You don't want it. You don't take it home with you, but it doesn't matter. It goes on a list of products that they say they give you and the insurance company pays them for. So as if that's not complicated enough, now what we have with the government stepping into this with hip waders and a big baseball bat is you have people that know nothing about healthcare making decisions about your healthcare. Let me give you a perfect example. Let's talk about breast cancer for a moment. Now, women who are daughters of women who have had breast cancer are highly likely candidates of getting breast cancer. And so typically what they do is about age 24 or so, they start getting mammograms. It's kind of a, if you've ever had one, which I have not, but I've certainly seen enough of them, they sort of mash the breast in between an emitter and a collector. And they shoot x-rays through the breast and they look for dense areas in the breast. It's not very good at detecting masses in the breast, but it's okay. There are a lot better technologies out there. There was a dual camera IR process that could spot it from across the room a year before a mammogram could do it without irradiating the body with anything. It was a receive only type of technology. It went through all the testing. Everything passed with flying colors. It did a wonderful job at detecting masses in the breast long before a mammogram could detect them. But unfortunately, the final board of the FDA was made up of members of Siemens and GE, and those are the people that made the mammogram equipment. And so they turned it down. And of course, after spending about $110 million developing and jumping through all the clinical hoops for the FDA, they were broke. And so now you don't have that technology on the market. What we need to have happen here is we need people that know stuff about healthcare to be in the system, and they're not. And we also need the system to leave the average person alone. Now, here's what Whole Foods did. This is their idea. You remove the legal obstacles that slow the creation of high deductible insurance plans and health savings accounts. That's what my company uses. We set up a $5,000 health savings account for the employee. It's their money. It's their slush fund, as it were. And when they get the sniffles or stitches or sore throats or ear infections or whatever, they simply go down to the doc in a box, they get their treatment, and they write a check off their health savings account. Their doctor's visit cost them $100. Their drugs might cost them $30, $40, $50, maybe $100, and they're done. That's it, $200. Let's just make it expensive and say $300. That's it. They paid it out of their health savings account, which has $5,000 in it. Now, their premium goes up just a little bit month by month to replace that money in their medical savings account until it gets back to $5,000, and then that deduction stops out of their paycheck. Now, going with that, because obviously $5,000 just takes care of everything that could possibly happen to a family of four kids and two parents in a year. That's over $400 a month in doctor bills. Trust me, none of you, or I would say 85% of you, don't even approach that, not even close. Okay? But going along with that, you got to have some kind of what's called catastrophic health insurance. The high deductible, guess what, is the $5,000. So if you get something that requires, say, $250,000 treatment, that's the kind of medical event that cleans you out, that bankrupts you, from which you don't recover in a decade. That's what you use the high deductible health insurance for. But only 15% of the people have anything like that. And typically, very typically, most of those people have some kind of pre-existing indication that they're going to have that problem. They're diabetic, or they were born with a heart murmur, or they had scarlet fever when they were 8 years old. I mean, lots of things like that set you up for expensive health problems later on. Those kinds of individuals can be taken care of separately. You don't have to throw everybody into the same pot. Now, the combination of high deductible health insurance, which, by the way, used to be available, but now there are so many legal obstacles for providing that, and Obamacare will not even let you do it, that is very difficult to get. That's one solution, and it could solve 90% of our healthcare problems. Health insurance is different than health care. Okay, keep that in mind. For example, Whole Foods Market pays 100% of the premiums for all their team members who work 30 hours or more per week. And that's about 89% of all the team members for their high deductible health insurance plan, which is significantly cheaper than the low deductible plans with the copay and the drug card and the blah, blah, blah that you normally see with an employer. They also provide up to $1,800 a year in additional healthcare dollars through deposits into employees' personal wellness accounts to spend as they choose on their own health and wellness. They can join a yoga class. They can join a fitness center like Gold's Gym or YMCA. They can spend it any way they want on their own health and wellness. The idea is that their employees are encouraged to keep their body weight in check, keep their body fat in check, keep their cholesterol in check, keep their blood pressure in check, not smoke, not drink to excess. And guess what? Those people don't get sick. What a miracle. Who would have thought that? My goodness. So when I worked at Nissan, we had about 6,200 or 6,300 employees at that time. And I got to tell you, there were no fat people working there. Now, it wasn't because Nissan didn't hire fat people. No, no, no. That's not it. Nissan had a $10 million sports complex. They had a driving range. They had a swimming pool. They had walking trails. They had aerobics. They had all kinds of stuff that the employees were encouraged to take to participate in. Plus, the plant was 52 acres under roof. And you walk from the parking lot to your workstation, it's about a mile and a half, one way. So if you're walking 2 to 3 miles a day and you're working on the line instead of hitting that refrigerator every 15 or 20 minutes, guess what? You're not going to be fat. 6,000 employees, four shifts, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I didn't see any fat people. And that's why, because those people took care of themselves. Now, the money's not spent in 1 year, in these health savings accounts. It doesn't go away. It rolls over to the next year and it grows over time and it belongs to the team member. They earn the interest on it. Okay, they spend their own healthcare dollars, which means they can bargain for the best price. They walk in. They don't have to go to the emergency room. They go down to the dock in a box. They can go into their doctor and say, I'm going to pay you today with a debit card or a check right out of my HCA or HSA. And you know what they say? Well, since you're doing that, we're going to give you a 35% discount because we don't have to pay the insurance processing people and we don't have to wait for the insurance company to pay us for the work we're doing today. And so without that overhead, we're going to pass the savings on to you. And it doesn't matter. You know, I was T-boned on my motorcycle, I told you, last May. I paid for everything out of my pocket. Nobody's insurance covered anything. Well, they should have. But insurance regulations being the way that they are, especially in the state of North Carolina, there's a clause called contributory negligence. And this says that if you contribute to an injury in an accident more than 1%, the insurance company doesn't have to pay. And if you ride a motorcycle, you automatically contribute 5%. So if you're hit on a motorcycle in North Carolina by another driver, you have to pay your own medical bills. Sorry, I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. So if you're going to ride a motorcycle in North Carolina, you better have your own injury insurance, because if you don't, no car insurance has to pay for you. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they rear-end you. It doesn't matter if they sideswipe you. It doesn't matter if they T-bone you coming out of a parking lot, talking on a cell phone, or texting a friend. It doesn't matter. You contributed to the injury just by riding a motorcycle. And the insurance companies like it that way. So that's the way it's going to stay. Now, the medical savings account is an asset of the worker himself. Now, obviously, you don't get that the first day that you start. You have to build that up over time, usually 1 or 2 years, to fully flesh out and fill up your medical savings account. But that is your deductible. And as you use it, you replace it. And you take care of your own healthcare costs. If you think about it for a second, every working American can afford their own healthcare costs. You just can. I don't care if you're a diabetic. Diabetic drugs are not that expensive. You don't need that $10 a month copay to take care of your diabetic drugs. You just don't. They're cheap. They're dirt cheap. High blood pressure medicine costs you $10 a month out of your pocket with no insurance. You don't need the copay. Health insurance is the expensive part. Now, you have to equalize the tax laws so that employer-provided health insurance and individually-owned health insurance have the same tax benefits. Now, employer health insurance benefits are fully tax-deductible, but individual health care insurance is not. And that, my friends, is not fair. It's not fair. If you're paying into your medical savings account, you're paying your high deductible health insurance, you're paying, let's say, $200 a month, that $2,500 a year should be tax deductible, but it is not. The next thing you got to do is you got to repeal all the state laws, like that stupid one I just told you about in North Carolina, which prevent insurance companies from competing across state lines. Did you know that North Carolina is a cancel rewrite state? That's right. So if you move here from, say, Tennessee, where you have health insurance, and you move to North Carolina, you can't keep your health insurance or your car insurance from Tennessee. It's required that they cancel your old policy and rewrite a new policy at a higher premium, of course. We should all have the legal right to purchase health insurance from any insurance company in any state. And we should be able to use that insurance wherever we live. So if you have an insurance company in Kansas that's flush with cash and they're writing insurance, health insurance policies for non-smokers and non-drinkers, and you live in South Carolina, you should be able to buy it. But you cannot today. You cannot, because states cannot compete with one another. health insurance should be portable. And it doesn't cost a single penny of government money, not a dime, nothing. All you have to do is change the laws. The next thing you do is repeal government mandates regarding what insurance companies must cover. These mandates have increased the cost of healthcare insurance by hundreds of billions of dollars. What is insured and what is not insured should be determined by the individual customer preferences and not through special interest lobbying. That's how free enterprise works, my friends. You buy the insurance that fits your lifestyle the best. You're a scuba diver, you're a stunt pilot, you're a snake handler, you're a welder, you're a house painter, or you're an accountant. Everybody has insurance needs that are pretty tailor-made to their lifestyle, their body style, their health history. And you should be able to compete state by state, company by company, to find the best insurance for you. The next thing to do, of course, it's long overdue, long, long overdue, and you know what I'm talking about. It's enact tort reform to end the killing of the fatted calf by lawyers that force doctors to pay insurance costs hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. In North Carolina, you will not find an obstetrician. I'm serious. You'll have to go to another kind of doctor or a midwife or go to another state, because our good friend, John Edwards, sued all of the obstetricians under a junk science ruling for cerebral palsy. And that's why it's absolutely untenable for an obstetrician in this state. It just doesn't happen. You don't find them. No clinics. They're all gone. They left the state. Can't afford it. We have to have tort reform. We've got to have it. These costs are obviously passed back to the insured at higher prices for healthcare. Again, an unfunded mandate. The next thing to do is to make the cost transparent so that consumers understand what healthcare treatments cost. Nobody knows that stuff. You don't get an itemized bill when you come out of the hospital. If you go to have some outpatient surgery, have something taken out or something put in, you don't know what all those costs are. You just see the bill. Finally, you got to revise the tax forms to make it easier for individuals to make a voluntary tax-deductible donation to help the millions of people who have no insurance and aren't covered under Medicare, Medicaid, or the state children's health insurance program. All kinds of people will do that. All kinds of churches will do it. All kinds of other nonprofit organizations will do it. Right now, there is no deduction for it. Many promoters of health care reform believe that people have an intrinsic ethical right to health care, to equal access to doctors, medicines, and hospitals. Now, while all of us empathize with those who are sick, how can we say that all people have more of an intrinsic right to health care than they have to food or shelter? It is obviously ridiculous, and it is a completely political point. Health care is a service we all need at some time, but we got to have food and shelter all the time. All right. I was just going to tell you that socialized medicine doesn't work. Government should stay out of it. Let free market forces work on it, and it will correct itself. Doctors will become more efficient. Hospitals will become more efficient. Clinics, what I call a doc in a box, will pop up everywhere. There's probably one every 5 miles in your city. You'd probably drive by it all the time. Urgent care, Medifast, tons of franchises out there. They're run by nurse practitioners. 90 to 95% of anything that's going to happen to you can be taken care of in there. If it can't be taken care of, it can be discovered in there long before it becomes a problem. Okay? Health care reform is important, but health insurance reform is what's going to kill our government. It almost killed the state of Tennessee when Hillary Care was adopted in that state. It became known as Ten Care. The state was flush with cash, had no state income tax. It still doesn't. But it had a balanced budget and money in several accounts. They passed Ten Care, and tens of thousands of people came from the seven states that border Tennessee, lots of them from Georgia, lots of them from Kentucky, Virginia, Arkansas. They came pouring into Tennessee. They all jump in the minivan, and they ride up to Nashville or Knoxville, and they get their health care for free. That's right. They joined Ten Care even though they live in Atlanta. They don't pay any state taxes in Tennessee. They don't buy anything in Tennessee. They don't own property in Tennessee. They don't pay any payroll taxes in Tennessee, but they get free health care in Tennessee. Guess what happened? 3 years later, the state's almost broke. 3 years, they're almost broke. Almost broke an entire state. That's what socialized medicine does. Another case in point, Greece. Greece has no residency requirements for healthcare. And guess what? Thousands and thousands of people pour into Greece every year for free healthcare. They come from Israel for free knee surgery. They come from Italy for a shoulder surgery or a liver work or a dialysis or whatever. And Greece pays it. And guess what? Greece went bankrupt. They went bankrupt. And it wasn't because people weren't working. It wasn't because they were retiring at 45 years old. They weren't that much of a drag on the economy. It was all the outsiders that came in and took the free health care. That's what broke the country. Germany doesn't want to pay for it, by the way. So it's a complex algorithm into which has been poured a tremendous amount of clown academics. And what they have done, and they've tried repeatedly, obviously since the mid-90s, to seize control of one-sixth of the American economy by totally taking over the health insurance business. But even more importantly, they are socializing the medicine system so that it creates a permanent dependent class. Once you create a permanent dependent class, you own them. They can't vote against you. And free elections disappear. It's just a way of buying a nation. It has happened before, and it is happening right now. Except, fortunately, there have been some very, very brave representatives in Washington that have stood up, they've filibustered, they've talked about how terrible this idea is. And what has happened is the Senate and congressional offices have been flooded with phone calls, absolutely flooded with phone calls to not fund this system of insurance, affectionately called Obamacare, by Obama himself, of course. And fund everything else in the government, all the Social Security, all the TSA agents, all the everything that gets normally paid for by the federal government is totally funded, all done. They're just not going to fund Obamacare. And so what the Democrats are going to do in about 40 and a half hours here is they're going to shut the government down, and they're going to blame the Republicans. And it's an age-old battle. It's been done 100 times. They're going to do it. They're going to do it. Come on. Pelosi's not even in Washington. Reid's not even in Washington. They don't care who says what about it. And they darn sure don't care what you say about it. They're going to do it anyway. And when they shut government down, they're going to stop sending Social Security checks. They're going to shut those food stamp cards off for about 72 hours. And they're going to blame the Republicans. And it will cost somebody dearly. But fortunately, you're listening to X Squared Radio, so you're informed and you know exactly what's going on, and you won't be taken in by it. Obviously, a superior move on your part. By the way, I want to let you know tomorrow, the next day, Tuesday, is the 1st of October. Most people who are pinching pennies and still want to get things for their loved ones for Christmas will start doing some of their Christmas shopping now, even before the Christmas ornaments are put out. Go figure. Anyway, I want to put a couple things on your Christmas list just in case you have that really hard to buy for person, or you have a person that you really care about and you want to make sure they're okay in times of a disaster. I highly recommend investing, and you can invest your money in all kinds of stuff, but I recommend investing your money in food. And if you go to xsquaredradio.com, on the right-hand side, you'll see the list of our fine affiliates, and right at the top of the list is the Food Investor. My good friends Scott and Danny out in Utah have discovered a way to prepare delicious food, and we're talking about really meals, but they've done it with no preservatives, and they've done it in a way that when this food, if you purchase it, is lightweight, it's well-packed, it'll keep for 25 years. That's pretty much set it and forget it food. So you get yourself one of your kids' old book bags, the ones they are too ashamed to take to school anymore, and you go to the Food Investor and you get yourself together a 72-hour kit or a one-month supply, and you fill that book bag with those supplies, and you stick it in the front closet, or you stick it in the trunk of your car. And when something happens, which it is rumored that it's going to, a hurricane, an earthquake, a forest fire, a tornado, a tsunami, an earthquake, EMP blast, whatever happens, you can grab that bag, you can head out the door with a canteen of water, and guess what? You don't have to pay any attention to FEMA at all. You're not going to be one of those ones sitting out on the curb in the smoke and the dust and the mud waiting for a little 3-foot by 3-foot blanket and some warm milk and cookies. No, you are going to be able to have 3 square meals a day, and you're going to be able to take care of yourself, and you won't have to rely on FEMA for anything because you went to the Food Investor. Now, you could do it for yourself, but seeing as how it's the Christmas season, you could do it for your loved ones. You could do it for your grandparents. You could do it for your kids, for your neighbors. That is a gift worth giving. And if nothing happens, what's the worst thing that'll happen? You could rehydrate the food and eat it. It's your investment. So pick up something from the Food Investor. Visit my friends Scott and Danny out in Utah. Click on the link at X Squared Radio and take care of yourself. I also want to remind you, until the end of the year, we have this challenge going on. It's going out to all my listeners, and thank you, thank you, thank you so much. So many people have taken advantage of this. I want you to go to alienatednation.com. The link is at xsquaredradio.com if you want to go there too, but alienatednation.com, and I want you to buy the paperback of that book. I'm going to send it to you autographed, and you're going to get the audio version for free. So if you're not a good reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. But I want you to take that copy that you buy with the autograph on it, and I want you to take it to your governor's campaign office. If you can take it to the governor's house or the Capitol building, that's fine. But I think it's very effective if you take it to the governor's campaign offices. And you take the book to them and you say, listen, this is a book that outlines a way for the 40 states that have passed sovereignty acts, and they're listed in the book, and they're also listed on Google if you want to look them up. And it motivates them to come together as a group of 40 states, one delegate from each state, 2, 5, I don't care. Generate the Constitutional Convention and repeal 3 amendments. Only 3, that's it. And pass 6 more. Those 9 amendments outlined in the book, if you follow the instructions in the book, we can take back the republic from the agency government that is ruling our country right now. And when I mean ruling, I don't mean governing. I mean they tax you, they fine you, they confiscate your property. They forbid you from doing business. They interfere with your commerce. And they can seize your assets and they can sue you. And guess what? You have no representation in that government at all. That, my friends, is the definition of tyranny. And that's what we have right now. We have a tyrannical government. No, it's not Congress. It's not the Senate. Those are clowns. I'm talking about the hundreds of thousands of bureaucrats that sit in all the agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations that rule your life. Oh, yes, they do. You go ask your boss at work what agencies are harsh in his gig, and he'll tell you. The EPA, the FAA, the FDA, and the numbers go on and on and on. And they are writing thousands of regulations every month. Congress knows nothing about it. Congress can do nothing about it. You can do nothing about it. But the states can. The states have a constitutional method called a constitutional convention, and they alone can save the republic. 40 guys, one weekend, one republic. Buy the book. Get it in the hands of your governor. That's the challenge. Let's take a quick break. Let's listen to some Foo Fighters. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
These days, the ground will drop out from beneath your feet. One of these days, your heart will stop and play its final beat. These days. one of these days, your heart will stop and play its final beat. But it's alright. Easy for you to say.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our Aki window forecast, actually about 61 degrees, very, very pleasant outside. Should be able to see some of those fireballs streaking across the sky. We do have a couple of updates on Comet Ison I would like to lay on you. I've got an update from Diana West, some of the academics giving her a hard time in the press again. As you know, she's been on the program twice, and her interviews are just spectacular, talking about history and the fact that history is usually written by the winners. And the history we have covering World War II and what was going on at that time, who was actually running the White House during World War II, no, it wasn't Roosevelt. It was the puppet master behind Roosevelt that was doing it, a Soviet spy named Harry Hopkins. And I'll talk a little bit about that later, how she's defending herself against a couple of academics, Horowitz and Radish, who are really giving her a hard time because she's obviously stirred up the poo, if you know what I mean. It's a southern term. It's like when you walk across the front yard and your neighbor's dog has left a burger in the yard, but you know, it's kind of oxidized on the outside so it doesn't smell anymore, but you inadvertently kicked it over and stirred up the poo, and well, you know what happens. It's a little stinky. That's what she has done. She's taken the white and crusty poo that we have been calling our history for about 80 years now, and she's kicked it over. And she's reminded this modern generation in her blockbuster book, American Betrayal, how wrong we have been and what was really going on in Washington. I highly recommend the book. I highly recommend the author. She's a great columnist. Her columns are found in Drudge Report, Breitbart, and other places, and she's doing a fabulous job in defending her great thesis against the academics. Bravo, Diana West. Bravo. By the way, you're not in good hands all the time. The number two officer at the military command in charge of U.S. nuclear warfighting forces has been suspended. That's right. He's been suspended and is under investigation by the Naval Criminal Investigation Command, officials said yesterday. The highly unusual action against a high-ranking officer at U.S. Strategic Command was made more than 3 weeks ago, but they weren't too transparent because they didn't make a public announcement about it. Air Force General Robert Kaler, the commander of Strategic Command, he suspended the deputy commander, Navy Vice Admiral Tim Giardina, from his duties on September 3rd, according to the command's top spokeswoman, Navy Captain Pamela Kunze. She is still assigned to the command, but is prohibited from performing duties related to nuclear weapons and other issues requiring a security clearance, she said. He is still assigned to the command. Kaler has recommended to Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel that Giardina be reassigned, Kunz said. Giardina has been the deputy commander of Strategic Command since December 2011. He is a career submarine officer, and prior to starting his assignment there, was the deputy commander and chief of staff at U.S. Pacific Fleet, way up there. Strategic Command oversees the military's nuclear fighter units, including the Navy's nuclear-armed submarines and the Air Force's nuclear bombers and nuclear land-based missiles. It's based in Omaha, Nebraska. Coons said Strategic Command did not announce the September 3rd suspension because Giardina remains under investigation and action on Kaler's recommendation that Giardina be reassigned is pending. The suspension was first reported by the Omaha World Herald, not a big newspaper. The spokeswoman said a law enforcement agency, which she would not identify, began an investigation of Giardina on June 16th. Kaler became aware of this on July 16th, a month later, and the following day he asked the Naval Criminal Investigation Service to begin a probe. And it turns out it had to do with gambling. It falls under a category, which I am not military. I don't even consider myself former military because I was in the Air Force only one term, a long time ago. But it is what we call being compromised. You remember the old saying, loose lips sink ships. You get in the wrong places doing the wrong things, and you compromise your mission. You compromise those with whom you work. You compromise those under your command or that do command you, because you have placed yourself in a situation where you can be blackmailed, where you can be pressured, where you can be subverted and twisted, and things can be done to use that against you and force you to do things the way they want you to do them or whoever wants to blackmail you. And that has been at the base of many, many military weaknesses over the years. And unfortunately, this guy just happened to have the red button in his hands. Scary stuff. And it goes on in government as well. We have seen already in the news a fair amount of that happening in the Congress, some of it happening in the Senate. People get to Washington, they no longer represent their people that elected them. That's what happened in Colorado. You had two Democrat Congress people that went to Washington, immediately turned on their constituents and passed gun control legislation with which their constituents would never have agreed. What did the constituents do? Well, they put together a recall election and they threw those bums out. And they replaced them with two Republicans that will have nothing to do with gun control of that nature. And that's exactly what you should do every single time that happens. Now, of course, we have a president who is compromised, multiple layers of compromising, so many scandals, it becomes unbelievable. There's a half a dozen on the surface. There's perhaps a dozen. There are perhaps a dozen under the surface, any one of which would have impeached a president, any of them, of the last 44, 43 presidents. So what's going to happen? Nothing. And you know why. But that being said, the president is completely emasculated. He can walk into a room and the room gets quiet because prior to his walking in, everybody was laughing their ass off. This guy's a joke and everyone knows it except him. All right. We do have a banking alert. This is a comment that was placed on a blog. I thought it was so significant, and I'll tell you why. Because I had one of my employees that couldn't get to the bank a couple Fridays ago to cash their paycheck, so I cashed their paycheck for them. They signed the back of the check, and I took the check to my bank and tried to deposit it. And my bank would not deposit it. Even though I've banked there for years, even though they know me face-to-face, they said, well, how do we know that one of your, that your employee signed this check? And I said, because I'm telling you face to face right here, right now, I cashed the check for my employee. It was a Friday. He couldn't get to the bank. He needed the money. Obviously, I cashed his check for him. They would not accept the check. So here we go. This is the blog, and this is why it's significant. We live in Lafayette, Louisiana. We own a small business and tried to payroll one of our employees. Our employee went to the bank to deposit the check into her personal account, and the teller told her it would be 7 business days for the check to go through. We thought that was odd, since the check is from a local Chase bank. This action usually takes 2 business days in our town. After waiting several minutes, she suggested what she needed to be done. Go to Chase, cash the check, and bring the cash back to this bank, and we'll put the cash in the bank. When the employee called me and told me the problem, I went to the local Chase bank and requested a withdrawal of the amount we owed her. We did this because the amount was over $5,000 and didn't want her to have any problems or to be flagged. The bank told me they couldn't cash the check because my business account was on hold and was closing the account. After nearly 2 hours and informing the bank manager along with several customers standing in that line that I guess there is a banking crisis going on, they brought me to another room and brought me the cash I requested. Our account had plenty in the account to cover the withdrawal. The bank informed me we were in good standing. I told the Chase employee about my employee having this difficulty and asked, is this new policy? He said it was, but they are supposed to inform the curious nothing has changed. And this is the way it has always been. I think bail-ins are around the corner. And we are right at the edge of a financial collapse. I pray your audience informs others of the situation and protects themselves and their friends and families. Now, this morning, Panamanians and gringo expatriates looking to escape the long arm of Uncle Stalin awoke to the world-ending reality that they are on a bank holiday till October 1st. Folks, this is not a joke. We have been warning you about this for about a year. Many of you have forgotten the bank's network shutdowns a few years ago in the UK with National West and RBS, the continued bank network failures over the years in the EU and the US were largely ignored as glitches. Now, the first chicken of the 2011 solvency crisis has come home to roost. Panama is down and are right now scrambling for solvency. Will they ask the Fed? Most likely, as Panama has always been a U.S. intel hotspot. The crisis is something that is not only being faced by the Panamanians, but the Indians, the Malaysians, Filipinos, Thai, and Indonesians, all nations that are being rocked by massive bank crises. Why? Simple. The dollar is being killed. You just have not felt the pain yet. Don't wait. Pull what you can now. We've been telling you for a year, slowly, very carefully, very quietly, get your cash out of the bank. Take it home. Put it in a jar. Put it in a leather billfold. Put it in your bed. But get your cash. Because when that bank goes on holiday, you're not going to get it. We've also advised you to cash in your 401k. Pay the 10% hit. Get the cash in your hands. Pay off your debts. Pay off those credit cards and cut them up. If you got money left over, divide it between cash and silver. I'm not alone in this. I'm going to play you a clip. This is from one of the top financial programs in the country. Listen closely. Here we go.
You're in charge. You're in charge of this thing called the United States government slash budget, and it gives you political and fiscal authority to do, quote unquote, the right thing.
Yeah.
Would you mark to market balance sheets today and create the economic downside that that would follow, or would you put in place or attempt to put in place some kind of economic policies to get you to a better place down some theoretical road?
I mean, how do you solve a problem where you're spending 10% of, you know, you're running a 10% fiscal deficit? You're not going to get growth in the absence of private sector credit demand. So the government's idea right now is we're going to export our way out of this. And yeah. When I asked a senior member of the Obama administration last week, how are we going to grow exports if we won't allow nominal wage deflation? And he says, we're just going to kill the dollar. And I said, okay, more you mean. That's the only answer. And it's a dead answer, but that's where we're headed.
All right. I don't know if you picked that up or not, but he said, we're going to kill the dollar. In 1929, we did not have the instant press we have today. There was no way for the average American to protect themselves from the engineered crash and deflation of the capital markets. But the signs have been there for about 5 years now. In 1928, we were in the second of two post-war recessions. And yet the stock market was partying like a rock star. The middle class was exploding by using margins. That's borrowed money for investments because interest was dirt cheap, to make gains in the stock market. The market policies allowed for a further leverage with a 10% equity for stock positions. That means you could buy a dollar's worth of stock for a dime. And there were millions of investors who had borrowed money from the bank at 3% interest to buy stock that was climbing at a rate of about 15% per year or more. The banks and their major shareholders allowed this capital inflation to continue until the point the dam was about to burst. Then they withdrew their money, crashed the money supply, and a few months later stepped in to buy whole industries for pennies on the dollar while the middle class evaporated like a giant financial dust bowl. Here we are in 2013, October, almost October of 2013. By the way, it was in October of 1929 that Black Tuesday occurred. We are here in 2013 after two major post-war recessions, threatened by a double dip recession, massive inflation of commodity goods, and a rocking stock market. The dollar has been inflated monthly by the Fed for about a year with no end in sight. In fact, the hint of tapering of the quantitative easing caused the market to let out a Jenga-like gasp before the Fed smiled and said, just kidding. Today, the government is poised to shut down due to a multi-trillion dollar showdown on Obamacare. Gold is cheap. Silver is cheaper than production costs. Stocks are setting hourly records, and more than 64% of Americans work for or receive a check from the federal government. We have as many manufacturing jobs today in America as there were in 1968. Banks have cut off nearly 100% of business lending. You don't believe me? You have a small business? Go try to get a business credit card without a personal guarantee. There is no such thing as new business in America. The agencies defaulted on 100% of the grants, loans, and loan guarantees made since 2009. All of them. Oh, they issued the awards, and the contractor ramped up to meet the demand, the government's demand. But when the delivery date came, the government didn't have the money to pay its bill. Ecotality is yet another victim of DOE failure to meet its obligation. The banking solution has already been demonstrated once. I've been telling you for about a year to cash in your 401k. Take the 10% hit and get the money into jars, boxes, whatever. I told you to buy silver as a storage metal and get yourself debt-free, except for your house. Pay your house off if you can. The credit bureaus will destroy your credit if you get yourself debt-free. You might as well get yourself ready for it. You may never be able to borrow money again or have a credit card, but you will sleep when the wind blows. You don't believe me? Ask your friends where they would rather be. 80% leveraged in debt with the creditors taking all but a few hundred dollars a month out of your soul, or debt-free? Go ahead. Ask them. They will all say the car loan, furniture payment, and credit cards are not worth having your heart pumping so hard at 3 o'clock in the morning you think you're going to die. It's your money. Get it out of the system before it swallows you whole and spits you out into the soup line. Now, let's listen to some more financial experts analyze what the heck is the federal government doing looking at your 401k. Get ready for this.
Keep away from my 401k. The government now pushing to lock up private retirement accounts as more people tap into them to pay their bills. The two senators pushing the legislation say they're trying to protect Americans for the future, but are they going too far? Hi, everybody. I'm Cheryl Cassoni, and welcome to Cashin' In. Our Cashin' In crew this week, Wayne Rogers, Jonathan Honig, Tracy Burns, along with radio talk show host and the president of Kaltbaum Capital Management, Gary Kaltbaum, and Democratic strategist Jamu Green with us as well. So welcome to all of you. And Jonathan, I want to start with you. You're the money manager here. Does the government have a right to tell us what to do with our 401ks?
Cheryl, government is supposed to act as our protector, not our parent. I mean, honestly, Senator Cole knows what's best for my family, for my investments. This is private money. It's money that folks, individuals have earned. And the notion that government knows what's for your own good, or they should tell you how to invest, where to debts to pay, what debts to pay off, how to put your money to work, it's absurd. You should be able to invest how you want, when you want, and government should have no role in influencing you to invest in anything or make any behavior in that regard.
But Wayne, I think the senator's concern here is that people are going too far in borrowing against their 401k. They're acting irresponsibly. Whether or not that's their right, that's a different story. But we have seen at this point more than 27% of folks out there borrowing against their 401k, and that number goes up every year. It's a little disconcerting.
It may be disconcerting, but I think it is the point. I think it is exactly the point. It is your money. You have every right. If you want to go to Vegas and gamble it, you can go to Vegas and gamble it. You have earned the money. You've put it in a 401k. That's still your money. Suppose you didn't elect to put it in a 401k and you just spent it. It's still your money. The government has absolutely no right to tell you what to do with your money. And for them to interfere, there's a whole insidious philosophy here about the government getting into our business on every level. This is just another example of it. They're going to somehow protect us. If we're not so irresponsible, we can't protect ourselves. We shouldn't be here.
Jamu, is this idea going just a little too far when it comes to personal individual rights?
Absolutely not. It's actually laudable that, you know, these two senators, a Republican and a Democrat, are trying to help Americans be more fiscally responsible. And I think what Jonathan and Wayne totally forgot in this debate is that it's retirement savings. Yeah. This is not your savings account that they're going into your personal savings account, you know, at Bank of America. This is your retirement savings. And we have a serious problem.
Yeah, do you know what?
In what people will need between what they will need and what they will have saved. There's a $6.6 trillion gap that is developing and growing.
But do you
know
how many
people... laudable that they're trying to attack this.
I mean, Cheryl, the reason that number keeps going up is because we are still in a recession here. And if that money were not available to many people, they couldn't have paid bills. Mm-hmm. They couldn't have fed their kids. Those loans came in handy. And to Wayne's point, it's my money. I use it the way I want to use it. And if I opt to pay withdrawal penalties and extra taxes, that's my own dumb decision. But I'm making that decision because I need to feed my kids. Not because I'm worried about what's going to happen 50 years from now.
Jamu, I have to say, when you said that comment, I think, Wayne, you already put him in the grave at that point. He about had a heart attack. But let me take this to Gary Kaltbaum for just a second. Gary, from a money management perspective, again, I go to it. This is our money. We've put it away. Why should the government have the right to tell us what to do with it and when?
Well, look, it's the continuance of the nanny state. They're going to tell us what to eat, where to walk, where to bicycle, and now what to do with your money. And I have to tell you, I find it ironic that two of the people that cannot balance their own checkbook in Washington, that have actually castrated the taxpayer going forward, are now going to tell us to do what to do with our own money that's in our 401ks. It's abysmal to even watch something like this, and it's not going to stop. They've been getting away with it for a while, and unfortunately, nobody's doing anything about it.
Jonathan?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's the same government that has pushed you into index funds for the last 10 years that have been dead money and keeps you out of investments like Facebook and, LinkedIn, which went public this week to a massive payoff. I mean, Kaltbaum has hit the nail on the head. For the government to lecture anyone about, you know, what's a good investment, how to be responsible with their money, is an absurd, not to mention the fact that all these rules, supposedly, Jamu, to help you, are totally arbitrary, totally confusing, and you're taking a loan. You're taking a loan from yourself. How you invest is your business.
But Jonathan, they're not stopping the ability for you to take a loan. They are just limiting
from
it.
Yourself.
And I would say, maybe three withdrawals is too small. Perhaps it could be five. Another great thing with this bill is that it stops the debit cards coming at, that are attached to your 401k, which can be
attached
really
to
dangerous.
Your
this is
money.
Pragmatic.
That's
it is reasonable, and it is for retirement savings.
Can I just
savings.
Say it's a precursor? It's a precursor to what we saw in Argentina. What we saw in Europe, which is basically the government confiscating private pension plans.
Let me bring in Wayne into this, because Wayne, I think the idea here might be a good one. They're trying to protect Americans who may be acting irresponsibly with their 401ks. We don't want to see folks in wheelchairs on the streets 30 years from now.
It's not their business. That's something more fundamental here. You talk about the government. Yo, it's a wonderful thing. The government's going to protect us from ourselves. Please, it's not their job. It's none of their business. They should get out of it. And that's a fundamental right. We are responsible people, and we're not. Are we going to ask the government to take care of us just because we're irresponsible? Because you're irresponsible. If you're irresponsible, you can't do it. You should be punished for it, be rewarded for it. And, Jamu, you're all wrong there. You're asking these people to put aside something. You're saying, for their future, it's wrong that they should even have to do that. It's their money. They should be able to do with it what they want. It's none of the government's business.
There's a bottom line here. What 401ks were designed for. Again, you can have a savings account at your bank of your choice, but 401ks were designed for retirement savings. And in this conversation, I think all of the fellas are totally forgetting that point.
But it's also got to be there in case of emergency. It is my money. There are hardship withdrawals. Many things are allowed to limit that kind of stuff. You don't know what's going to happen. And you know what? And if the government had half a brain, hell, they'd be encouraging me to take money out because of the taxes and the withdrawal fees. They'd be making money off it.
And there's a bigger bottom line here.
The fact that it's designed that way is immaterial. It doesn't matter. The government can design all kinds of programs. We don't have to do it. You're asking us to be forced to do it. That's the difference.
Gary,
The bigger bottom line here is these are people that have been failures at handling of money, and they're trying to tell us what to do with our money. It's like Bernie Madoff trying to tell me how to manage my client's money. It is absolutely insane. These people do not know what they're doing, but they want to dictate policy to us. Crazy.
I will say one thing to Jamu, and I do see your point in a way. This idea, this legislation does allow folks to go and borrow up to three times. So it's a threshold. It's not necessarily saying you can never borrow against your 401k. I mean, from a money management perspective, it might make some sense.
Absolutely. It is helping Americans be more fiscally responsible. There are so many people who are not taught about saving. So many young people, so many people from vulnerable communities, they're not taught about saving. And when 401ks were designed to help ease people into saving money in larger quantities and to help from a retirement savings standpoint. Again, this is not your personal savings.
But then teach the kids in school. You don't need another law. You don't need another bill. Teach the kids in school how to manage money and let them make their own decisions.
But Jonathan, final point to you. Is it the government's right to tell us what to do with our retirement savings?
I mean, Cheryl, you know, the money doesn't know whether it's in a 401k, whether it's in gold bars under your couch. I mean, it doesn't. It's your money. You work the hours for it. A call palm hits the nail on the head. For the government to be lecturing us about fiscal prudence is idiotic, and it keeps us out of making ultimately more efficient and sounder decisions with our money.
I have a feeling Gary's got a lot of gold hidden somewhere, probably in his couch. All right, guys.
Well, the point that I wanted to make here is that it is your money. It is taken directly out of your paycheck, pre-tax. It's put in there. That's why you pay the 10% penalty when it comes out. If it increases your income for that particular year, you're going to pay some additional taxes on it. The 10% penalty is just because you're taking it out before age 62. So there is already a penalty for doing it, and that's what precludes most people from doing it. People take that money out because of emergencies, not to buy food for their kids. I thought that was a ridiculous statement. But if you have a healthcare problem or you want to put your kid through college or you have something terrible happen like a house fire where you're uninsured or you have a liability come up that you must pay or you just want to get yourself out of debt, you look at your debt situation, you say, my gosh, I've done a terrible job managing my finances, but there's no way I can get out of it. I've lost my job. I'm going to ruin my credit. I'm going to lose my house. So you go to your 401k, cash $10,000 or $20,000 out of that, pay all your debts off, lower your overhead where you can make it on a lesser job or a part-time job, and it's a fiscally responsible thing to do. Now, what I'm asking you to do as the host of X Squared Radio is to warn you, is to accept this warning that the federal government is now making a lot of noise that they are about to seize the entire 401k IRA program, all of it. They're going to take all the money, and they're going to give you an IOU. And they're going to say, don't worry about it. It's all safe. Every dollar has been accounted for, and now you don't have to worry about a thing. When you reach that retirement age of 69 or 72, don't worry about it. That money is going to be there for you. We guarantee it. The faith and credit of the United States of America is now behind your 401k. Don't you feel better about that? I didn't think so. All right. Lots of comments coming in on that one. I appreciate it. I have a couple of things. I'm going to cover this article right here because I'm giving it a little bit of credence. It's a few days old, about 3 or 4 days old. It's put out by James Bailey. It has 32 comments, and the comments are pretty powerful. And being that it's timely and possibly a little prophetic, but it could have some bearing. I'm from California, so this means a little bit to me. Three independent sources have recently claimed that the Lord told them a large earthquake is going to hit the west coast of the United States on Thursday, October 3rd. Two of these sources identified the earthquake will measure 9.7. That's a little bit of a stretch because that would make it the most powerful earthquake in recorded history. Since 1900, we started measuring the force of earthquakes. The very largest one was a 9.5 in Chile in 1960. It was also associated by a 38-foot tsunami, which caused actually most of the casualties. The devastating earthquake and tsunami that destroyed northeastern Japan in 2011 and was responsible for the Fukushima disaster was allegedly a 9.0, and I think that's absolute crap because I watched the earthquake on recorded cameras at the site, and it didn't look a bit over 5.9 to me. No broken windows, no rearranged cars, no cracks in the roads. Even the statues in people's yards were still standing up. There's no way that was a 9.0 on the Richter scale. The tsunami that came in was assisted by something else down in the trench in the ocean. It caused a 133-foot tsunami that that came in and was and devastated the Fukushima reactors. And fortunately, the people had already gotten to high ground because the tsunami alarms were going off. But they stood up there on the high ground and watched the tsunami literally just take everything out. Now, it's also a rare thing for the Lord to give people specific dates and Richter scale measurements for these events. In fact, I would go so far just to say it's pretty much non-existent. Usually, people only see scenes from what is coming, but no dates, no values, no numbers. So to hear three independent sources all hearing the same date makes this all kind of unusual, because it could just be any old date. According to these sources, the Golden Gate Bridge will be broken in half by the tsunami. That is highly unlikely, probably impossible. You have no idea how high the bridge is unless you've driven over it, but I can tell you that the tallest steamships, the tallest ocean-going vessels, go under this thing with enough room to fly an airplane between the ship and the bridge. A tsunami of that size would take out a third of the state. All right. Adam H. issues a warning. I'm not going to play his YouTube, but I will read the transcript. This video is about what my mom has been telling me for the last day and a half. She has been having dreams and visions about a large earthquake off the west coast of the United States. She has had something like this happen to her once before. It was right before the Japan earthquake and tsunami. She basically predicted it. It was pretty intense. It was about 2 days before the event. This one, though, she says she has seen numbers and dates and times. It is early October in the daytime, sometime in the morning on a Thursday. The warning we are hearing is a 9.7 earthquake off the west coast. Now, he was reluctant to give the exact date in the video, but he did anyway. Now, something that you are always aware of because you listen to this program and others like it. It seems like whenever the agencies are doing a drill, like Department of Homeland Security, like the TSA, like your basic, what would happen if we had a shooter in a movie theater? Or what would happen if we had a shooter at an elementary school? Or what would happen if a couple guys brought, let's say, backpack bombs and blew them up at the finish line of the Boston Marathon? It seems like every time we have a drill like that, the thing we're having the drill about happens at the time that we're having the drill. Like, let's have a drill that two airplanes fly into the World Trade Centers. And it happened on the day that they were having the drill. And the reason that I bring this earthquake stuff up is there's a great shakeout earthquake drill set, you guessed it, for October 17th, 2013. Now, they're off by 2 weeks, but that's not so bad. Who's off? Is it the prophetess that's off, or is it the government that's off? In less than 2 weeks, maybe just a skunch over 2 weeks, individuals and communities throughout 10 states in the central U.S. will participate in the fourth Great Central U.S. Shakeout Earthquake Drill. Now held annually on the third Thursday of October, the shakeout is set for Thursday, October 17th at 10:17 a.m. Central Daylight Time, which, by the way, is 9:17 California time, or maybe it's 8:17. During the self-led drill, participants practice how to drop, cover, and hold on. Endorsed by emergency officials and first responders, the proper response to an earthquake is to drop to the ground, take cover under a sturdy table or desk if possible, protecting your head and neck, and hold on until the shaking stops. Oh, I have an even better idea. Jump up in the air and stay there. Following FEMA's National Preparedness Month in September, great shakeout earthquake drills are occurring nationwide in more than 40 states and territories. More than 12 million people are expected to participate in drills on October 17th. In addition to the safety drills, many participants take extra steps to become more prepared for earthquakes. In the central U.S., scientists estimate that there is a 25 to 40% possibility of a damaging earthquake occurring within a 50-year window. That would be the New Madrid Fault. A large earthquake here could have major impacts on the population and national transportation, communication, utility, and financial systems. If the same quake occurred today that occurred in the early 1800s on the New Madrid Fault, the one that made the Mississippi River run backwards, it would flatten every bridge that crosses the Mississippi River. It would effectively, very effectively, cut our country in half. You know how long it would take to start replacing bridges over the Mississippi River? Yeah, a long time. All right. Coordinated by the Central U.S. Earthquake Consortium and the states of Alabama, Arkansas, Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Tennessee, nearly 3 million people participated in the third Central U.S. shakeout in February of 2013. To align with other states and regions throughout the country, the Central U.S. shakeout will occur in October going forward. For the October 2013 drill, Ohio is being introduced as a full participating state. Ohio has a similar earthquake risk to surrounding states such as Indiana and Kentucky, which is the New Madrid Fault, and has also had damaging earthquakes in years past. So they're being added to the roster. The goal of the program is to engage participants to take steps to become better prepared for earthquakes and other disasters. Obviously, the drill is free and it's open to the public. By the way, Alex is reminding me that this is the same lady, the so-called prophetess, that once said the ground underneath Mississippi was supposed to split wide open. Didn't happen. I was there. Didn't happen. Mississippi is just fine. By the way, Governor Jay Inslee has proclaimed October as Washington State Disaster Preparedness Month and NOAA Weather Radio Awareness Month. Local jurisdictions, individual schools, and businesses across the state will promote all hazard preparedness throughout the month. Geez, I just hate it when they have these drills. It's just one of those kinds of things that just wiggles the spider senses. You know what I'm saying? All right. I promised you an ISON update. And after this, we're going to do a Monsanto update on account of I have received this month's For a Better World magazine. It's a great magazine. It's a Fair World Project magazine. They do all kinds of stuff for farmers, and they issued this magazine, and I think they take a really good right cross at our friends Monsanto, and I'm going to read that. ISON update, because a lot of people have been asking me about it. I was on Truth Frequency Network yesterday with Chris and Sherry, and I said exactly the same thing pretty much that I'm going to say tonight. As they have correctly reported, for the last 3 years that I have been attending the Truth Frequency Network from time to time, I, and only I, have been 100% right on all of these events. Elenin and other events, I've been 100% right. And I can tell you, I am right on this one too. Comet Ison has been the most talked about comet of 2013. It was discovered in late 2012. It was said to have the potential to become a striking object visible to the eye alone without any, you know, binoculars or telescope around the time of its perihelion or closest point to the sun. which is November 28th, right after Thanksgiving of this year. People started saying Comet Ison and is the comet of the century. In June and July, Comet Ison was behind the sun as seen from Earth. But when it recovered in early August, it wasn't as bright as we had hoped. Coming toward us like that, it should be a little fuzzball that you might be able to see with a 20 power, might take 30 power to see it. What will happen when Comet Ison is in the remaining months of 2013? Well, comets are notoriously unpredictable, but it's safe to say that many are waiting to see if Comet Ison will sizzle or fizzle. Which will it do? Well, there are some unique things about Ison we should consider. And these are my opinions. They are professional opinions. You can respect them or not respect them. But, you know, the next 90 days will prove it out. First of all, Ison is a first-time star grazer. This means that the ice that incorporates the head of the comet is what we call pristine ice. Now, we're not sure at this time whether it's CO2, methane, or just water, salt water or fresh water. And this makes a difference because the temperature at which it will start off-gassing is key to its stability while it is far from the sun's Roche limit. The Roche limit, as you know, if you've listened to this program, is the point at which the sun's gravity will overcome the internal gravity of the comet's head, and most astrophysicists will agree the formula is correct. It is about one diameter of the stellar body or the planetary body away from that body is where the Roche limit begins. That's why when you looked at Comet Shoemaker, as it got close to Jupiter, the gravity of Jupiter overcame the gravity, the internal gravity of the comet, and the comet fell apart into 12 chunks. And it struck Jupiter in 12 pieces instead of one. It wasn't nothing. There was no solar wind. It didn't off-gas. Nothing was crazy about it. It's just that comets are normally a loose handshake of a bunch of chunks of ice. And very little gravity in this stuff. But if it's only a few kilometers across, it is enough gravity to keep it together while it's going through space. But when it gets in the field of the gravity of another planet, it comes apart. However, if it is a solid chunk of ice instead of a loose corporation of chunks, then there is hydrogen bonding that keeps it together. Very tight, very difficult to overcome, and the sun's gravity may not break it apart. It could survive. It could pass around the sun, a little smaller, but still together. We shall see in December of this year. Right now, no smart person is making bets. I would guess that it will probably come apart, and we will not see it come out of the other side of the sun. It's not going to be like Lovejoy. All right, number two, the density of the head of the comet will have a big impact on whether it will cross Earth's orbit or even Mars's orbitable path. If it's dense enough, it may stay together after the off-gassing events and stay on path. Number three, and this is why comets are so darn unpredictable in telling exactly where that trajectory is going to be. Because the jetting of the surface of the comet can steer the comet to a different trajectory. It's like powerful retro rockets on this thing. Now, we see the comet moving, but from the comet's point of view, the solar system's moving. You got it? When it starts off-gassing, it's like retro rockets, and it pushes the comet around. It's sort of like lighting a pinwheel and throwing it out on the street. You don't know where it's going to go because the sky rocket that's attached to the pinwheel is pushing the pinwheel all over the place. Comets do the same thing. This is why they're so hard to track when they get affected by the sun's heat, especially if they're small. If they're big, they got enough mass, like, you know, Hale Bopp or something, Halley's Comet, then they'll pretty much stay on path. ISON will pass within 700,000 miles of the sun, and it will be a mere 70 million miles from Earth, whereas Elenin was about 200 million miles from Earth. That trajectory can take a variety of turns during the off-gassing period. If it gets too close to a planet, it will most certainly be pulled in a new direction. Right now, the odds of an Earth collision are about zero. But the tail and whatever is being pulled along in the dark behind ISON will cross Earth's orbit after the sun-grazing event. If the tail remains intact, which is very likely, given the almost non-existent solar wind, I told you today it was only 250 kilometers per second. You can about run that fast. That's the lowest I've ever seen for a solar wind. If the tail remains intact, Earth will collide with it. Just the tail. Now, it could be just a bunch of bad breath. Or it could be a conflagration event like the Great Chicago Fire. I told you the story of the Great Chicago Fire. I read it on this program. It was an event where we passed through, we passed through the methane tail of a comet. That methane was dense and highly charged, and when it came into the atmosphere, it ignited because it was mixed with the oxygen in the lower atmosphere. As it descended upon the city of Chicago and four other states, it burnt buildings made of concrete and steel to the ground in 5 minutes flat. Not only that, but there were people that ran out of the city to escape the flames that were coming down out of the sky. And they, at that time, Chicago was surrounded by a bunch of construction yards, which had a lot of steel beams and cranes and things like that. They ran out into these areas because allegedly there was nothing flammable out there. But groups of people were found dead on the dirt with the coins in their pockets fused together. And they were not burned. The people were not burned. They were killed by electrostatic discharge. They were killed by lightning bolts that came out of this cloud of methane that came rushing down on the ground. Not only that, there were forests, whole forests, that were burnt to the dirt in just a few minutes. One of the stories in the account that I read on the air was from a man who was at a sawmill near one of the areas in the forest that had been logged out. All the trees had been cut down. The only thing that was around him were stumps and dirt, okay? And there was a pond of water that had a pit beside of it that was about waist deep in water. He heard the fire coming down out of the sky. It was catching the trees on fire some mile or two away. He was in the clear-cut area. So he pulled some slabs. Slabs are the initial cut that's made by the big saw that contains the bark of the tree. It isn't used for much, sawdust or, you know, filler, but it isn't used to build anything because it has the bark. It has the wane of the tree on it. So he pulls the slabs over. These are about 2 to 4 inches thick of solid wood with the bark on the outside. Pulls the slabs over and covers the pit of water. And pulls the last one in place and jumps into the water and pulls the last slab over his head. So he's now under a wooden lid that's 2 to 4 inches thick, and he's waist deep in the water, which is quite chilly. He said the fire approached at such speed that, and it created so much heat that he was grabbing double handfuls of water and throwing it up on the wood that was over his head to keep it moist. And by the time the fire finished passing over his head, the water that he was in was bathtub warm. It had actually warmed the water. That's how hot it got down in that pit. When he heard that it had gone by, he flipped one of the slabs over and climbed out of the pit. Of course, the top of the slabs were just charred. And every stump was burnt to the dirt. Now, stumps are not flammable, folks. This is the last foot or so of the tree when they saw it to the ground. All the logs had been hauled off. There was nothing to burn. It was not even any grass. It was just dirt and stumps. But that fire was so intense that came down out of the sky that it burnt the stumps all the way to the dirt and nearly killed him. He survived. That was the Great Chicago Fire. Now, right now it does not appear the comet Ison will become a legendary comet of the century. Comet Ison might still break into fragments when closest to the sun, as I correctly predicted Elenin would do in 2011. Or comet Ison might survive its encounter with the sun, as comet Lovejoy did in late 2011. And if so, when it emerges from its closest point to the sun in late November, it might become visible to the eye. And there is one thing we can count on. That is, if Ison does become a bright comet visible to the eyes of watching Earthlings, it will be spectacular. All comets are. No doubt about it, comets have a mystique. Once considered omens of doom, we now know them as icy visitors from the outer solar system that sweep near our sun and disappear again into the depths of space, perhaps never to return. Now, people get excited about comets. They are temporary visitors to our region of the solar system. This comet might not be as bright as hoped for, but it will be watched. I'll be there. I hope you will be too. The bottom line is this. Comet Ison, also known as C2012S1, is headed for a close encounter with our sun. A really close encounter. 700,000 miles from the sun is right next door. Although some thought this comet might become spectacular later this year, the chances are not so good. If it was so, it would be visible now by binoculars, and it's not, which means it's not really off-gassing the way people thought. I'm just telling you, there's a month-by-month update, not from the government, but also from amateurs that are watching this very, very closely, and they have really good equipment. By the way, there was an author a number of years ago. His name was Anthony Larson. He wrote three books, which were kind of like science fiction, but they weren't. They're very interesting books, and if you get a chance, you should read them. The one, they're based on scriptural descriptions, but he throws the astrophysics behind it, which really makes it interesting. The first book is called, if I recall this correctly, it's probably been 25 years, And the Moon Shall Be Turned to Blood, I believe was the first one. And the second one is, And the Earth Shall Reel to and Fro. And the third one is called, And There Shall Be a New Heaven and a New Earth. Now, I wouldn't take these to be scripture, but they are quite descriptive. And if you're not an astrophysicist and you're not a biblical scholar, they'll be fascinating to you because they bring all this stuff together. Anthony Larson, good author, really. Really good author, and it's a good, clean book, and the science is pretty strong. So let me do this. Let's go ahead and take a quick break, give my voice a little bit of a rest, and we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio. We're going to cover mining the moon for helium-3, and we're also going to cover this Monsanto article. You don't want to miss it. We'll be back.
kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cuts your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. It's September 29th, 2013. Coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 59 degrees and clear. By the way, you can step out about 6:09 in the morning if you're on the East Coast and see the International Space Station coming overhead. Coming out of the west. Appreciate you so much being with us tonight here on X Squared Radio. Many of you are listening live. As always, it's free on the BBS Radio Network. This is where the mainstream is not. In fact, if it's not mainstream, it's probably here on the BBS Radio Network. The BBS Radio Network is the largest content provider of webcast radio content in the world. And I'm proud to be here now this month, 8 years, 8 years at BBS Radio, and very much appreciate your faithful support of the program. This is an archived, a paid-for archived program, so obviously if you're not listening live, you're listening to the archives. If you are listening live and you have friends that cannot stay up this late or are doing something else on Sunday evenings, please share with them the link to become an archive listener. It's about $2.50 a month. If you do it month to month, it's $20 a year, which is cheaper than a cup of coffee a month. And what it does, because of the volume of people that listen to this program, that little bit of money is all we need to keep the lights on here. We pay for our airtime, and we support our wonderful producers out in Paradise, California, that keep bringing this content to you year after year, keep upgrading the sound equipment so that the quality of what you hear improves year after year. And we have new features for 2014, including video, including a much higher quality audio. It's not like some of the tinny, you know, blog talk stuff that you hear out there with a bunch of garbled content from time to time. This is the highest quality that you can find anywhere. And we have, I think, the finest collection of hosts anywhere on the planet. If you feel you have what it takes to be a host at bbsradio.com, please get a hold of me. I'd be happy to make the introduction for you and help you with equipment or whatever it is you think you might need to learn in order to be a webcast radio host. Our phone lines toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can get to that cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537, and go ahead and put that conference line into your speed dial. It's 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and then the passcode 769-608 pound. If you have any questions about tonight's program, you feel too shy to call in and talk with me about it, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. Please bookmark x2radio.com. Please like us on Facebook. Every little bit helps and doesn't cost you anything. It's all free. Be a friend. All right. We have an interesting situation on our planet as we are struggling for energy. Some time back, we figured out how to convince electrons to come in from wherever it is they come in from, to jump on our copper and aluminum wires, allow us to push those electrons along with whatever current we could muster, and we have figured out how to use that electricity as to perform work. Maybe we're the first generation to figure that out. Most generations before us were pretty much clueless to that and thought if any work was to be done, it was going to be done by some animal or descending water turning some kind of wheel. The world is beset still with energy problems. Fossil fuels are being depleted, gasoline prices are growing, and there is great concern that our increasing carbon emissions will raise global temperatures uncontrollably. Even though that's been stable for the last 15 years, it does have its effect. It's showing up in the ice. It's showing up in the tree rings. It's showing up in the sediment layers. We are polluting our planet. Now, admittedly, petroleum is cheap power. I mean, it is. Come on. You want to take you and five of your friends up the road for 20 cents a couple miles? That's pretty darn cheap. If you go to China and you rent a rickshaw and you tell the driver, I want you to take me and four of my friends 2 miles for 20 cents, you'll be pummeled severely about the head and shoulders. Petroleum is cheap transportation. However, it is stupid in some cases. When we're talking about low mileage, short range, lots of stop and goes, that kind of delivery, gasoline's horrible. We have better solutions. With rapid industrialization occurring in India and China, home to more than 2.3 billion people. Believe me, these problems will just become worse. There are no catalytic converters in those two countries. There are no gasoline formulas that are clean burning in those two countries. You don't believe me? Go to Shanghai. Go to Bombay. Go to Nepal. Go to Tibet. Ride for a little while. You'll see what I'm talking about. Choking, smoking, nasty, eye-burning fumes all day long, and it's getting worse. However, there is one fuel source that could save the world from a dark future. A fusion nuclear reactor powered by helium-3 could provide enormous amounts of power without any harmful carbon emissions or the radioactive byproducts created by today's nuclear fission reactors. There are only two problems, and they're not small. Nobody has yet created a nuclear fusion reactor that could run on helium-3, largely because the Earth has so little helium-3 that you would have to mine the moon to get it. Just a couple days away. Scientists and engineers are working to solve both problems. And not just government, also private sector. Current power plants use nuclear fission, a process in which uranium nuclei are split apart. This releases energy, but it also produces radioactivity and nuclear waste, like we're seeing with Fukushima. It must be securely stored for thousands of years. In nuclear fusion, however, nuclei are fused together rather than split apart. These reactors use the same energy source that powers the sun and the stars. However, nuclear fusion does not produce the radiation and nuclear waste that is harmful to human life. Scientists have been working for many decades to try to produce a working fusion reactor. Basically, what we're talking about is a controllable, small-scale hydrogen bomb. Okay? It turns out that destroying nuclei is a lot easier than fusing them together, and that's why we have several hundred, about 470 nuclear reactors performing fission all over the planet and creating tons and tons of nuclear waste. The process results in a significant loss of energy and is difficult to contain. Scientists have had a difficult time creating a fusion reactor that would put out more energy than it needs to operate. We have achieved cold fusion, but we need to achieve hot fusion. Scientists are exploring how to develop a fusion reactor that uses helium-3 and another compound called deuterium. Actually, deuterium is just hydrogen with a neutron. Hydrogen, as you know, is a single proton. Helium has two protons. And helium-3 has, you guessed it, three neutrons, two protons. The process would create normal helium and a proton, which are easy to contain. The process, if it can be perfected, would produce no radiation and virtually no waste. Did I say neutron? I meant proton. Three protons. If scientists can perfect such a reactor, they will need to get fuel for it. Unfortunately, as I said, very little helium-3 occurs naturally on Earth. Although helium-3 is abundant in the solar winds emitted by the sun, we're not too good at gathering it. Most of the atmosphere gets most of it. The moon, however, has no atmosphere, and it gets constantly bombarded by H3 from the sun. So there is abundant helium-3 locked up in the lunar regolith. Mining the moon for helium-3 would not be that easy. Miners would need to process about 1 million tons of lunar soil in order to get 70 tons of helium-3. The fuel would then have to be shipped back to Earth in bulk. Given the potential of this power source, it's likely that many nations would try to mine the moon for helium-3 once a working fusion reactor was invented. And let me tell you, a new gold rush would occur on the lunar surface later in this century. H3, helium-3, is worth about $1 billion a ton. Yeah. What did they call that stuff? Oh, yes, unobtainium. Unobtainium in the movie Avatar on the planet Pandora. Similar stuff. But it's not that hard to actually set up operations on the moon. I know. You're thinking, well, there's no atmosphere. It's so far away, you know. But come on, guys. You're not going to be bombing around on the surface of the moon in a golf cart or a moon rover. We're talking about serious equipment here. All you have to do is use the volcanic vents that are long since dormant on the moon, already there. Just seal off that opening, go down inside there, and build the city. That's all you got to do. You'll be below the surface. You'll be protected from all the meteorites. You'll have water. You'll have oxygen. You'll have gravity. Easy peasy. All you have to do is make sure that the equipment that you take outside has a pressurized cabin. You don't have to keep it at 14.7 pounds per cubic inch. You can keep it at half that, which would be about the pressure at about 10,000 feet. A lot of people can work at that altitude and become acclimated to it. And the equipment could be largely automated. You could just drive big drones, big drone tractors or scrapers. And with gravity being 1/6 what it is here on Earth, the bearings, the tires, everything will be a lot less wear and tear. We're just talking about volume here. Now, if we were to switch over our power generation over to helium-3, there would never be the risk of a Fukushima again. And what's the risk of another Fukushima? The first commercial nuclear power stations started operation in the 1950s, and many of them are still working. There are now over 430 commercial nuclear power reactors operating in 31 countries. They provide about 13.5% of the world's electricity as continuous, reliable baseload power, and their efficiency is increasing. 56 countries operate a total of about 240 research reactors, and a further 180 nuclear reactors power some 150 ships and submarines. But it's all old technology. Nuclear technology uses the energy released by splitting those atoms apart, just generating heat, boiling water, making steam, turning a turbine, yawn, yawn, yawn. 1950s technology. We are still rubbing two sticks together to make fire. Today, only 8 countries are known to have nuclear weapons capability. By contrast, 56 operate civil research reactors, 92 of these in developing countries. 31 countries host 434 nuclear power reactors with a total installed capacity of over 372 billion watts. That's a lot of power. But helium-3 could make a lot more and could make it cleaner and no risk. Now, the U.S. government remains more involved in commercial nuclear power than any other industry in the United States, period. There are lengthy, detailed requirements for the construction and operation of all reactors and conversion, enrichment, fuel fabrication, mining, and milling facilities. The review process preceded the construction of new reactors can take 3 to 5 years. The U.S. government, through its own national research laboratories and projects at university and industrial facilities, is the main source of funding for advanced reactor and fuel cycle research. As of mid-2013, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was reviewing 10 applications for the combined construction and operating licenses to build 15 new reactors. So it's still going on. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's fiscal 2014 budget for oversight of the 100 operating power reactors was $1.055 billion, including 6 reviews of extended power uprate requests and 10 license renewal applications, just so you know. These are just the facts. And then, as if this is not enough, yeah, we're generating all this electricity. It's at 60 cycles per second. It's three phase. We got to keep the phases coordinated. We got to keep the frequencies coordinated because, after all, we're building this giant grid. We're tying it all together. Enter the NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. It is a not-for-profit entity whose mission is to ensure the reliability of the bulk power system in North America. They have nothing to do with advanced technologies. They have nothing to do with low-voltage local supplies like solar or wind or that's going to supply your local systems with some kind of backup or some kind of reverse meter buy-in. They have nothing to do with any new technology that could power a house or power a car. They were founded in 1968 by representatives of the electric utility industry for the purpose of developing and promoting voluntary compliance with rules and protocols for the reliable operation of the bulk power electric transmission systems in North America. Now, that being said, remember I used the word voluntary compliance. We want you to do this. We're going to give you all the training that you need. But since 1968, it has grown into something quite different. Historically, the NERC connected the various industry participants through a voluntary council. That's the way it started out. That changed with the passage of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which called for the creation of an international electricity reliability organization. It's called EPACT. Marked a fundamental shift in electricity regulation in the United States. Now, a lot of the aspects of the NERC changed. Its authority changed. Its ability to enforce that authority changed. So the NERC works with industry stakeholders and federal agencies. There's that agency government again. To ensure all views are fully considered, the greatest possible level of consensus is achieved, and trust and confidence of regulators, industry, and the public is gained. Basically, they're the men in black of the electrical industry. Unlike water or gas, electricity cannot be stored in large quantities. You can't make a reservoir. You can't make a tank. It's got to be generated the instant it is used, which requires supply to be kept in constant balance with demand. Now, things have happened on the demand side to make it smarter, to make it more efficient, to not make it to where you can throw the switch anytime you want. That's called peak demand. And things have been done on the consumption side, which are called smart meters. Smart meters watch your electricity usage just like they've always done, except that instead of a meter reader coming around to your house once a month and writing down all those silly numbers off those little mechanical wheels, the old expensive meters, and then they would go back and calculate your bill, and then they would send you your bill and you would pay it. They had no idea what electricity was being used at 6 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 10 o'clock at night, neighborhood by neighborhood. They didn't have a clue. They had a general idea, but they couldn't exactly match supply with demand. Now, what the smart meters do is every two minutes, they take a time-based total of the energy that's been used. Now, the smart meters will then, through a tiny radio board inside the meter, will broadcast that usage. That broadcast is picked up two ways. One is by a repeater that's in your neighborhood. All the condos and apartments and houses in a subdivision will send their little radio signals out. The repeater will pick it up, boost the power, and send it on to the electric company, which receives it on a real-time basis in little packets, and they calculate the usage minute by minute almost during the day, neighborhood by neighborhood, demographic by demographic. And it allows them to control the power that goes to each substation and the power that's being generated at the plant, which makes it very efficient. And it makes the cash flow to the system much more profitable. They love it. The other way that they collect it is a little truck drives through your neighborhood. You've seen them with the little flashing white light because they drive kind of slow. Inside that truck is a receiver that picks up the signal that's being broadcast by the meters, and they drive around your neighborhood and collect all the information, and then they drive back and download into the central computer at the power station. So once a week or once a day or a couple times a month, they can gather this information neighborhood by neighborhood, and they can control the amount of energy that they expend. It makes them more profitable, 24 hours a day, not just once a month. Now, a lot of people complain about the meters because they say, oh, the radios, you know, they're really bad for us. It's utter nonsense, complete nonsense. We're talking about a 5-watt or a 2-watt little board made by Zigbee that puts out this signal. It's on the frequency of the old pagers. Remember the pagers, you know, used to have on your belt? They go beep, 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 and they'd show a phone number in there, and you'd have to get off the freeway and find a pay phone and return the call. Yeah, the pager frequencies, they were just left there unused by the FCC or by anyone else. And the smart meter people bought the frequencies, and that's what they broadcast on. So it's harmless, absolutely harmless. Now, it is being expanded as we speak because those capabilities are also being made two-way, which means that the power company can send a signal back to your house or your apartment or your condo, and some of the meters are equipped with a relay that they can cut off your power. Mostly apartments, because people move in and move out and they have to be able to cut the power off remotely instead of sending a person out there to pull the meter. It's easier that way. But those little boards are also being put in some of the major appliances. Water heaters, heat pumps, air conditioners, the things that use a lot of power. Because the electric company foresees a day when it's particularly hot. They can tell whether you're home or not because they can tell if the TV's on or other things based on the draw through your meter. They know the draw from your different appliances, and they can tell if you're home or not. If you're not home and your air conditioning's running like mad, they can take, say, 10,000 air conditioners across town, and they can shut them off for a couple hours. Say from 2 to 4 in the afternoon, just shut off your air conditioning. It's called shaving. And they shave the demand and keep the power company from having to burn coal or run water over the dam or make steam at the nuclear power plant and save some money. And that's why those boards are being put into your new appliances. No, they're not going to come to your house and install that stuff if you've already got that stuff in your house. But the new appliances, that's why a washer and dryer can cost so much more. That's why a water heater is probably going to cost another $30. That's why your heat pump's going to cost a little more, because it's going to have this two-way board in it that the power company can communicate with. Your thermostat in your house is also going to be have that circuit in it. That doesn't mean that they're going to come retrofit all the old houses, but they're going to do the new ones that way. Now, they have probably already changed out all your meters, and there's nothing to worry about with the meters, all right? So just don't write me and say that the smart meters are killing you, because they're not. They're less harmless than a transistor radio. All right, but this is not harmless. This is my issue of For a Better World magazine. It's a free publication. This is issue 7, fall of 2013. And they've done a really good job. Dave Murphy is one of the writers for this, and he has written an article. It's kind of short. I'm going to read it. I want your comments on it. Write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and we'll comment about it. This is about stopping Monsanto and take back our food. It's a noble gesture, Dave, and I will tell you why it is a gesture only. Once you get to the end of this article with me, you'll understand. Stopping Monsanto is one of the most pressing issues of our time. As a single company, Monsanto is just the tip of the iceberg representing the threat that unchecked corporate power has in corrupting our democratic institutions, driving family farmers off the land, threatening human health, and contaminating our environment. The problem with Monsanto is not just their corrosive lobbying practices, but the fact that the products they produce, genetically engineered food crops made to resist high doses of the chemical weed killers they sell, are in more than 70% of the processed foods that we eat and feed our families every day. Everything from corn chips to cereal, soups, every kind of processed food you can imagine. In terms of corruption and consumption, Monsanto's reach is global. Their toxic impact reaches far and wide, from farmers' fields to our nation's capital to leading universities to media editorial boards and even to the White House. Along the way, their patented genetically engineered pollen contaminates organic farmers' fields. Their poisonous chemicals infiltrate our waterways and our food, and their lobbying tactics undermine our basic American rights. After more than 100 years in business, Monsanto's name has become synchronous with greed, arrogance, corruption, and poison. In a stunning display of calculated callousness toward the impact that their products have on human health and the planet, Monsanto is responsible for some of the most lethal chemicals known to history, including Agent Orange, PCBs, and DDT. In the 1980s, Monsanto made a strategic decision to combine their chemical company with the emerging science of biotechnology. Today, the same company that poisoned America's veterans in Vietnam is responsible for producing the food that appears on our plates every day. If you think that the same company who lied about the health impacts of Agent Orange to the U.S. government and our veterans is telling you the truth about the science behind genetically engineered foods that they are feeding us, then you are either uninformed, delusional, or perhaps a member of Congress. This past spring, Monsanto made the single largest strategic error in their 100-year history when they finally succeeded in sneaking a special corporate loophole protecting their genetically engineered crops from judicial review into a must-pass spending bill. By successfully pushing for Section 735, now known as the infamous Monsanto Protection Act, Monsanto finally exposed the truth to millions of outraged citizens about how they operate as a lawless corporation willing to manipulate our nation's laws to protect their flawed GMO technology and able to get away with it because our elected officials at the highest levels have become accomplices in the ultimate corruption of our nation's laws. Now that Congress and the President have shown their true colors to the American people and free citizens around the world, it is our civic duty to expose and resist this descent into lawless tyranny that not only keeps the American people from having the basic right to know what's in our food, but also prevents open and independent scientific studies from being conducted on patented GMO crops. The fight over the Monsanto Protection Act has become the turning point in the debate on political lobbying and genetic engineering in the U.S. For the past 20 years, Monsanto has been able to get their laws written behind closed doors while no one was watching. Today, however, we've built a movement that is paying close attention to every lie they tell the media and our elected officials, watching for every time they try to corrupt our democracy. At Food Democracy Now!, we are greatly encouraged that activists and everyday citizens around the world are waking up to the toxic impact that corporations like Monsanto have on our planet and are willing to join the growing movement to take back our basic democratic rights. For far too long, Monsanto has been allowed to operate under the cover of darkness, manipulating our elected officials, the media, and scientific institutions who would normally all serve as safeguards against their deeply flawed technology. Their unchecked power is corrosive to the health of our democracy, our well-being, and our planet, and it must be stopped. As free citizens, it is our right and our duty to protest their unlawful encroachment into the most basic and fundamental aspects of our lives, the food that we eat, and the laws that govern us. What elected officials and Monsanto apologists need to know is that we will no longer be silent. Monsanto's days are numbered, and the era of telling lies and getting away with it is over. Monsanto and our elected officials have one choice now. Label the GMOs in the U.S. or they will go the way of the dinosaur. Thank you, Monsanto. Your corruption has become your own undoing. That's Dave Murphy's article. And the publication is For a Better World. It's a free publication. We get it once a month here, and we really appreciate it. In the final 15 minutes of the program, I want to once again really praise Diana West for her great book, American Betrayal. You know, she's been on the program twice. If you've listened to the program, you already know most of this. But you should also know that prominent academics who have been feeding factory history down the throats of our kids and our college students for a long time are very arrogant. I consider them academic pinheads because in the face of facts, in the face of letters and documents and photographs, in the face of ledgers and reports that are factual evidence of what went on during World War II, they are sticking to their old history. Groundbreaking books about the history of communism, such as Robert Conquest's The Great Terror or Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago or Viktor Suvorov's Icebreaker, are never written by, quote, professional historians. Indeed, historians typically meet those books with remarkable hostility. Yet, non-academic history books certainly have their advantages. For one thing, they are readable, unlike some of the academic crap that's been fed to our kids and me. More than often, not. They are better researched, too. Above all, they are intellectually honest. They're free from the unspoken taboos of the academic world and from allegiances to theories and to colleagues that tie the hands of many an academic. Where a professional historian pursues an academic career, like I could just imagine having a degree in history and having tenure at a university as a historian, give me a break. The amateur seeks after the truth. He's ignorant of taboos. The amateur can follow the trail of evidence wherever it leads and discover things which according to the academic conventional wisdom, are best left untouched and unsaid. But those are exactly the things that we want touched, that we want said. And that is what Diana West does in her American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. By her own admission, she started that book with no intention of writing much about the Cold War. She didn't start as a historian, but as a simple mortal, puzzled and disturbed by the obvious question, how on earth could this great civilization of ours have degraded into such a hypocritical nonsense as political correctness? I mean, give me a break. Every single one of you just want to stick your fingers down your throat every time you hear this crap on the television or on the radio. Well, having written her previous book about the death of the civilization of grown-ups, now Mrs. West, in her own words, attempts a postmortem, only to discover unmistakable signs of a murder. She digs deeper, tracing references and footnotes backward along a well-mapped historical route that one simply, that she realized had just simply fallen into disuse, as she puts it, and discovers the true history of the 20th century, the history of communist crimes against humanity, to which so many in the Western establishment were accomplices and collaborators, and then a massive cover-up of those crimes, which infested our entire public life with a culture of hypocrisy and double standards. You would want to know that, wouldn't you? You would want to know that truth, wouldn't you? Well, it is this search for the causes of our moral crisis that brings her as far back in history as the 1930s. You remember that? When the Great Famine was artificially organized by the Soviets to force the peasants into collective farms, and the Western media consciously helped Stalin to cover up that mass murder, 40 million people starved to death. She cites a fascinating account by a repentant journalist who had been present at the meeting of Moscow Press Corps when the Soviet chief censor, Umansky, to work out a formula of denial after one reckless correspondent reported the news of the famine in 1933. After much bargaining in the spirit of gentlemanly give and take, the formula was agreed, wherefrom the Western journalists and the Soviet censor proceeded to party with vodka and luxurious snacks until early hours in the morning. The next day, it was infamous Walter Duranty who took the lead in attacking the famine report as an incompetent and biased big scare story, and then explaining, quote, "There is no actual starvation or deaths from starvation, but there is widespread mortality from diseases due to malnutrition." To understand this episode, Mrs. West comments, is to understand the extent to which Orwell's Newspeak had its birth in the pages of the Free Press as much as the totalitarian censor's office. Looking back over more than three quarters of a century of big lies to follow, this initial instance, the first time, demands a level of scrutiny and reflection it doesn't ordinarily receive, not having been recognized as the original sin that would ultimately corrupt us all. The bottom line is that we had some questions that came up, and when we went to go find the answers to those questions, we were saddened. As Lincoln once walked out on his porch with one of his reflections, he saw a squirrel running across his yard. And the squirrel hopped along and hopped up under the side of a giant oak tree in his yard, went up the oak tree, and disappeared into the trunk. And then Lincoln realized something as he sat there recounting the story to one of his officers. The tree was hollow, and it had to be cut down, or it might fall on the house, killing them in the middle of the night if a storm came up. So he told his officer, "You know what I wish?" And the officer said, "What's that, Mr. President?" "I wish I'd never seen that squirrel." Here are the questions. How the most important strategic decisions of World War II, such as effectively abandoning the Italian front to concentrate forces for the invasion of Normandy, were taken because Stalin demanded them. Against the counsel of Churchill and military commanders on the ground, the pro-Soviet FDR administration rejected such sensible alternatives as advancing from Italy to the Balkans up the soft underbelly of the Nazis and Eastern Europe, which might have limited the Red Army's advance to the West. In other words, had we stayed the course that Patton wanted to take, Berlin would have been free instead of behind the Iron Curtain until the mid-1980s. How did that happen? How every attempt by anti-Nazi underground in Germany to secure Allied support for their plots to overthrow the Nazi regime was thwarted by Soviet agents, not in the Soviet Union, but in Washington, D.C., because the German conspirators were anti-communist as well as anti-Nazi. So another opportunity to destroy the Nazi regime and win the war years before it blew up into its world status, without letting Stalin conquer half of Europe, was lost. How the notorious Yalta Division of Europe, surrendering half the continent to Stalin, was accepted by the pro-Soviet FDR administration without any serious attempt to find an alternative solution. In effect, the U.S. simply went along with the Sovietization of Eastern Europe in breach of Yalta Agreement and betrayed the Allied democratic governments of the Eastern European states. Why did that happen? How did that happen? How did thousands upon thousands, almost 20,000 American POWs that were captured from the Nazis, they were simply abandoned after the war? They didn't rot in Nazi prison camps. They rotted in Soviet gulags as hostages to Stalin, in the vain hope of preserving good relations with Moscow after the war. Thousands upon thousands of airmen and support crews and ground crews that were captured by Nazis that should have been freed after the war were recaptured, transferred to Soviet gulags, and lived out their lives in mines and in farms, forgotten and denied, not just by Roosevelt, but also by Eisenhower. How did that happen? Who would have allowed such a thing to happen? Because Washington, D.C. was being run and watched and coerced at the highest levels by hundreds and hundreds of Soviet agents, not the least of which was Harry Hopkins, who was the co-president serving right beside President Roosevelt. By the time Roosevelt finished his first term, he was suffering from dementia, probably Parkinson's disease. His polio had immobilized his legs, and he was losing his ability to lead. Sure, he was the governor of New York. Maybe he was a good president for 18 months. But the other three terms that he served, he was nothing more than a wax seal stamper for Harry Hopkins. Harry Hopkins ran the country. He ran the war. He manipulated American forces and hundreds of thousands of Americans died because of his decisions. Well, I got news for you, and this probably comes out in the book, but it most certainly comes out in the interviews. When the Cold War was over, there were not a lot of for sale signs in Washington, D.C. They never left. They're still there. Their kids are there, and their grandkids are there, and they're still running Washington. Right now, in the White House, with full Secret Service protection, is an Iranian-born woman named Valerie Jarrett. She is as much a Soviet spy as Harry Hopkins. And what's happening right now in Washington is all of those high-level decisions are being made in the best interests of someone else, not the United States of America. Everything. Obamacare, the manipulation of the dollar, the movement of the gold, everything that is occurring at these high levels is being manipulated by former Soviet agents. They're still in Washington, and they're deeply embedded into the agencies that Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins set up in 1933. We are now 80 years later, and they have a firm grip on the rule of the United States of America. Wake up, America. Wake up. All right. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Remember to look for the good in people every single day. Try to help it grow. As you do, before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew saying, peace, Earth Explorers.